Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, opposition to a proposed casino near Shippensburg. But up front, the U.S. Supreme Court has 23 cases on its docket for this term. Four of them are considered significant or major. Decisions could come down later this month or in early July. Two of the cases are from Pennsylvania. Religious liberty is the issue in Fulton versus City of Philadelphia, involving a Catholic social services agency that refused to comply with Philadelphia's laws against anti-LGBTQ discrimination in adoption placements. Also, in Mahanoy Area School District versus BL, Brandy Levy, a Pennsylvania high school cheerleader, was penalized by her school after she posted a profane social media tirade complaining about her failure to make the varsity squad. Levy was off school grounds and posted on a weekend, so she claims the school had no jurisdiction. To talk about these four cases and then other Supreme Court actions during this term, joining us today is Dr. Michael Moreland, professor of law and religion and director of the Eleanor H. McCullen Center for Law, Religion, and Public Policy with the Villanova University School of Law. Dr. Moreland, welcome to the program.
Glad to be with you.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Before we get into the specific cases, Dr. Moreland, tell me why the June term of the Supreme Court is usually significant.
Well, it's when the justices wrap up their work for the year. The term starts in October and then goes through the summer. And often the most contentious cases, the cases where there's the most writing, both for the majority and dissents, often those cases take a long time. And so they often end up being the very last cases handed down before they leave the term at the end of usually at the end of June, very beginning of July.
So during that time from October to June or early July, what's happening behind the scenes? I mean, obviously, with dozens of cases that the court is considering, not every day is a justice writing, not every day is a justice looking at all these cases. What goes on behind the scenes during those months?
Well, of course, they resolve a lot of cases earlier in the term, and they've been handing down decisions for several months now, often cases that are unanimous or nearly unanimous, cases that are relatively easier to decide in some respects. And it's important for people to realize that a lot of the Supreme Court's docket is composed of cases that don't get much public attention, very technical legal issues that get resolved over those months. So that's a lot of what they're doing is in different justices' chambers is writing opinions on the cases that are a little easier to resolve and then passing opinions back and forth among the chambers. But then, as I said earlier, it's the harder cases that take up more time toward the end. Because those tend to produce longer opinions sometimes, and opinions where there's maybe a little more contentious tone between majorities and dissents.
All right, let's talk about those four cases that I mentioned up front that many of the experts are pointing to as being a little more contentious and as being a little more significant than some of the others. Fulton versus City of Philadelphia. It involves a Catholic social services agency that refused to comply with Philadelphia's laws against anti-LGBTQ discrimination in adoption placements made subsequent to a city contract. The justices' questions during oral arguments seem to point to a ruling in favor of the Catholic agency that would restrict the impact of the 2015 ruling establishing a right to same-sex marriage, making clear that LGBTQ Americans could not expect the same protections as other groups. It would also raise questions about whether the newly conservative court might one day revisit that 2015 ruling. Now, by the way, I want to mention that I'm getting a lot of these descriptions from the publication The Intelligencer, so I want to give them credit. But what about this case? Where do you see the lines falling down here?
Right. As you say, it's a case about the city of Philadelphia's decision to revoke the license for Catholic Social Services to provide foster care services to place kids with foster parents because Catholic Social Services refuses to do so with same-sex couples. So Catholic Social Services and foster parents sued Philadelphia for this decision. And as you say, at oral argument, at least a majority of the justices, the more conservative justices, seemed sympathetic to the argument of Catholic Social Services here that that there's a problem here with regard to the religious liberty rights of CSS to engage in this kind of charitable work, notwithstanding their view that they can't place foster kids with same-sex couples. It's one of these cases that's somewhat similar in certain respects to the Masterpiece Cake Shop case from a few years ago, where you have a clash of sorts between anti-discrimination rules with regard to LGBT discrimination and then the rights of religious actors. And so we'll see what the court decides. There's the possibility here that they could issue a very broad ruling that would rework the scope of protection under the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment. That would kind of in other cases have a lot of implications, or they might decide the case more narrowly, more based on the facts here about how the city of Philadelphia went about making its decision, its kind of shifting justifications for its decision. And so we'll have to wait and see how broad the implications of this case for other kinds of religious liberty claims turn out to be.
And, you know, I think one of the reasons I'm not going to ask you or anyone else to predict the outcome of these cases. But one thing that court observers have mentioned is that the Roberts Court seems to be carving out, a wider path for religious liberty. Would you agree with that?
They have issued a series of opinions, it's true, in different contexts, some involving church ministerial employees last year, for example, cases involving funding for religious schools, where the court has been, broadly speaking, sympathetic to religious claimants. In this context, it is interesting. You mentioned Obergefell, the 2015 case recognizing the constitutional right of same-sex marriage. If you take that case and also the case they decided last year that held that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act's prohibition of discrimination based on sex includes a prohibition or was interpreted to include a prohibition on discrimination based on gender or sexual orientation, there's a way in which, you know, the court on the one hand has expanded protection constitutionally and statutorily for LGBT discrimination, but on the other hand, in a case like Fulton and in the ministerial exception type context, has also said that there's a space for religious institutions that are resistant to the full impact of those cases. And so there's a way in which the court is, in a sort of way, is trying to intentionally or not kind of find a truce in the culture war around some of these questions, and how successful that turns out to be, we'll have to see.
So is it too simple to describe this as a case of Fulton being a case of religious liberty, the religious beliefs of this Catholic Social Service Agency versus discrimination against LGBTQ community?
I mean, at one level, I think that's fair. It's worth pointing out, as Justice Alito pointed out at oral argument, in the case, however, that there are actually no same-sex couples that were denied service by Catholic Social Services because none had come to them, and that there were other agencies that were licensed by Philadelphia that did and do still place foster kids with same-sex couples. So from that standpoint, there's a way in which, even on the record of Fulton, you can kind of find a way through to sort of letting everybody have their piece of the pie. But again, it's inevitably going to be a controversial set of issues.
But would that establish a precedent? I mean, if the court were to rule Fulton, wouldn't that establish a precedent that other organizations that have religious ties can say, oh, wait a minute, we're not going to provide foster children or allow foster children to be in the care of same-sex couples or families?
Well, again, it depends how broadly they write the opinion. If they write it in such a way, if the holding is couched in such a way that it, as I said, has a widespread implications for how we understand the free exercise clause of the First Amendment, then yes, it would give religious institutions expanded protection to engage in activity and charitable works and whatnot in ways that would be contrary to the anti-discrimination law in some places. If it's narrower, though, like in Masterpiece Cake Shop, remember, in that case, they decided that because of the way in which the Colorado Human Rights Commission had gone about making its decision, they held that that evinced a kind of bias against religion in that case. And they could hold something like that here, that the way in which some of the comments by certain officials in Philadelphia, the way in which the city went about making its decision evinced a kind of bias against religion. If that turns out to be the case, then it would be a narrower holding, really kind of confined to the record in a case like Fulton, and then we'd have to wait for another case that might have broader implications.
That is Fulton versus the city of Philadelphia. I want to move on now to another Pennsylvania case, Mahanoy Area School District versus BL. We had talked about this case on our program a while back. Brandi Levy, she was a Schuylkill County High School cheerleader, penalized by the school after she posted a profane Snapchat tirade complaining about her failure to make the varsity cheerleading squad. Now, she was off campus on a weekend when she made this post. The issue is censorship of on-campus and off-campus speech, of expressions which are disruptive of school communities. It doesn't seem to apply very clearly to many people. Many schools and educators, supported by President Biden's administration, have argued that ending a school's authorities over students at the gates could make it harder to curb bullying, racism, cheating, and invasions of privacy, all frequently occurring online. The American Civil Liberties Union, representing Levy, has argued that students need protection from censorship and monitoring of their beliefs. This case comes down to this young woman was upset. She went on social media, recorded this video, put it out there. It was on a Saturday morning off campus. The school district saw it, suspended her for that year as far as off the cheerleading squad. It seems like a case of freedom of speech, First Amendment. How do you see the case?
Yeah, the court has heard of a number of these student speech cases over the years, and of course there are a lot of them in the lower courts. And this is the first case, though, that squarely, at least at Supreme Court level, poses this question of what kind of reach do schools have to discipline students for speech that occurs off campus out of school. And it's an interesting case in a lot of ways, even though the facts might seem to be, kind of mundane, involving a cheerleader who didn't make the varsity squad and post this thing that, using obscenity and criticizing the school and whatnot. So I think it'll be an interesting test case for, as I say, how broadly to apply the ability of schools to sanction students for off-campus speech. In this 1969 case, Tinker versus Des Moines, involving a student protest against the Vietnam War wearing black armbands, was the first in this line of cases. And there the court famously says that students don't lose their free speech rights at the schoolhouse gate. And as people have been pointing out, in a social media environment, the schoolhouse gate now could be everywhere. That if schools have this ability to punish speech that occurs off campus, then it means that all kinds of speech could be swept up into possible discipline. On the other hand, as you say, the school districts on these issues are always worried about harassment and bullying and various kinds of student behavior off campus that reaches the school in some sense, is kind of targeted toward or directed toward the school, and thereby they should be able to punish this kind of speech. So it's hard to guess how they'll come down on this case. A couple of justices, Justices Breyer and Kavanaugh, said a couple times in oral argument that it's hard to kind of write a big overall treatise or kind of theory here of what the how the First Amendment should apply in a case like this. So I expect it'll be pretty fact specific, whatever way it comes out. But it's another, as I say, another of these cases in this interesting line of cases about student free speech.
You know, you just said something that would be fact specific. Does that mean that it may be a little more narrow than, a broad ruling?
That's possible. I mean, there are a few things in this case in particular that they're a little peculiar. It involves an extracurricular activity is one aspect of it that it's hard to know exactly how that would cut, but it's worth pointing out. There's also some concern you heard from some of the justices that it seemed like a little bit of an overreaction on the part of the school that they punished her somewhat severely by suspending her from the cheerleading squad for the whole year rather than just, you know, giving her a warning or something like that. So it'll be interesting to see how those aspects of the case turn out. I mean, on the extracurricular activity point, I think it's probably pretty clear that the school could impose certain kinds of codes of conduct or the like on participants in an extracurricular activity that then could subject students to sanction for violating them. But you couldn't do that, for instance, with regard to student speech on, say, political matters. That's very much protected by the First Amendment. So how the court navigates those aspects of the case will be very interesting to see.
Social media has opened up so many different issues for the Supreme Court to consider just in recent years. And I'm sure that as technology changes over the years, that there will be more coming up in the future. Going to talk about a couple other cases coming up in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest during this portion of the program is Dr. Michael Moreland. He's professor of law and religion and director of the H. McCullen Center for Law, Religion, and Public Policy with the Villanova University School of Law. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are @smarttalkwitf. Had a clarification here about another case, Dr. Moreland. Is the Supreme Court reviewing the nature of the draft and if it is discriminatory? I know they won't be making a ruling on the draft per se this term, but I thought I read where they were going to review if it is discriminatory. That is a case that, I don't know, has it been taken up by the court yet?
No, in fact, the court just decided this week not to take a case challenging the mail-only selective service registration requirement. But there was an interesting statement in that denial saying that basically encouraging Congress to take a look at whether or not the selective service requirement should still be mail only. But for now, the court turned down a case that would have raised that issue.
So it's back in Congress's hands now. Another case being considered during this term. A few years ago, this may have been at the top of the list for media and attention from Americans as well. But now I think we're kind of used to it by now. And that is the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. In this case, California versus Texas, the plaintiffs claim the tax power justification of Obamacare's individual mandate, which the court articulated when it upheld the law in 2012, it fell apart when Congress repealed the tax penalty in 2017. The related question is whether the rest of Obamacare can stand even if the mandate falls. So just to be clear here, when Congress repealed the individual mandate saying you must have insurance, this case is basically saying that, the rest of the law should be thrown out as well. How do you see the case?
Well, what Congress did is they, so to speak, they zeroed out the penalty. So the court, as you say, upheld the individual mandate in 2012 on the premise that the tax enforcement penalty that was used to enforce the individual mandate made it a tax, and therefore it could be upheld under Congress's taxing power. Now that there's no penalty, though, for failing to procure health insurance under the individual mandate, does that mean that that individual mandate now is unconstitutional? And if so, does the rest of the statute, the rest of the Affordable Care Act, have to be held unconstitutional as well? I think it's pretty clear. This, of course, came up in Justice Barrett's confirmation hearings. There was a lot about it in the run-up to the argument in November. I think it's pretty clear that whatever they do with regard to this now zero penalty individual mandate, that the court is not at all inclined to hold that thereby the rest of the Affordable Care Act, including many of its popular provisions, such as keeping kids on insurance till they're 26 and coverage for pre-existing conditions and so forth. I think the court is not at all inclined to hold that the rest of that is unconstitutional. It's a somewhat technical area of law called severability, whether if part of a statute is unconstitutional, does that mean that the whole statute is unconstitutional? And in other cases, and then including an oral argument in this case, I think the court has pretty clearly indicated that a provision like this, whatever its constitutional status, this zero penalty individual mandate, that the rest of the statute can still be upheld or doesn't have to fall if a small provision like that is held to be unconstitutional.
But are there other cases where that severability was applied, that the whole thing was tossed out, even if there was just a small part of it that was ruled unconstitutional?
Well, it gets into some technical questions about, you know, how important is whatever provision is being held to be unconstitutional, how important is that to the overall structure and implementation of the statute? And again, in this context, I think the severability analysis, we'll see what the court decides, but my money would be on the view that the court will hold that, again, whatever they decide about this zero penalty individual mandate and its constitutional status, that precisely, in some ways, precisely because it's now a zero penalty individual mandate, that all the other regulatory provisions in the Affordable Care Act aren't really affected by the constitutional status, for good or ill, of that provision.
You just said my money would be on. I'm curious, and, you know, and this is an attempt at humor. Do law professors put money on or have a poll of how the Supreme Court is going to roll?
There are no betting pool that I'm aware of. Certainly, people do often, you know, try to prognosticate about how decisions will come down and try to read the tea leaves from oral argument, where sometimes you get a sense of a justice's sympathy or hostility to an argument being made by one of the lawyers. And again, in this Affordable Care Act case, I think that arguments kind of line up in favor of saying that the severability analysis is such that the rest of the statute will be fine.
I don't know, Dr. Moreland. It could be bigger than March Madness in those pools out there. Does a case out there, Brunovich versus Democratic National Committee, it could, this is a very timely case because it has to do with election law. At issue are bans imposed by the state of Arizona on so-called ballot harvesting, and we've heard about this here in Pennsylvania. And what that is third-party collections of sealed mail ballots and on counting votes cast in the wrong pink precinct. The stakes could be bigger if the court's conservative majority chooses to raise the bar for challenges to voter suppression practices under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 to more or less requiring a showing of racist intent as well as racist results. Now, that background I just read there probably could be a little bit confusing if you're not familiar with some of the cases here. But if you would, kind of lay out what the court will consider.
Right. It's an issue arising under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which the provisions of the Voting Rights Act that were held unconstitutional by the court a few years ago involving so-called preclearance provisions under a different section. But this is a section that allows plaintiffs, voters, in this case, the Democratic Party, to bring claims that a state's election regulations in one way or another have infringed the right to vote on account of race. And as you say, it involves some out of precinct voting practices and also anti-ballot harvesting provision in Arizona law. And so I do think that on this one, given the conservative composition of the court, it's likely that the court will say that absent a showing that Arizona's motive here has a racial discriminatory motive, that they'll say that these kinds of measures pass muster under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And it will give a lot of, it will be controversial if the court decides that, of course, because there is pending in Congress legislation both to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act and to cure the constitutional defects that the court held in Section 5, that were present in Section 5 a few years ago. And then also, of course, this big voting rights legislation that appears to be in some trouble in the Senate. And so it'll be kind of part of a larger conversation around voting rights issues. But I do think that the court's direction in these kinds of cases has generally been to give the state some leeway with regard to these practices, so long as there's no showing of patent racial discrimination.
A couple of things that you just said there. Legislation that is currently being considered. How often, or does it at all, does the court, when they know that there may be a remedy, legislative remedy, being considered by the Congress, or if it's a state case, by a state legislature, do they take that into account when making a ruling, or do they just base their ruling strictly on the laws that are there?
I guess in a important sense, they base their rulings on the laws that are already there. So this opinion, however it comes out, will be applying Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act as it is here and now, and it will kick over to Congress to deal with any issues with regard to if people think, as many on the left do, that there's a kind of under-enforcement of voting rights protection, then it will kick over to Congress to come up with a solution to try to remedy those issues in a way that's constitutionally permissible, of course. So I don't think the court so much tries to kind of anticipate what Congress will do or takes into account what pending legislation there might be. They're applying the law as it is, and then of course it's then up to Congress if there are particular aspects, say, of the Voting Rights Act that don't cover this kind of thing, and Congress wants it to be covered, then they can write a statute that does that.
You also used the word motive, and I know that this doesn't apply for every case, but is the Supreme Court in the practice of trying to determine what the motive of a litigant is? Without, for example, the state of Arizona would not come out and say that, this is designed to suppress minority voters. But does the Supreme Court read between the lines sometimes and say your motive here is to that, that in essence you're trying to limit the number of voters here?
Well, it gets into a kind of technical area of law sometimes called disparate impact. That is to say, if you can show that some action by the government, and this comes up, it also comes up in the employment setting as well, of course, if you can show that some action has a disparate impact on racial minorities, but is not motivated or not is not intentional racial discrimination, can courts recognize that kind of disparate impact as the basis for holding that what the government has done is impermissible? And so that's part of the issue here in this voting rights context, of course, is that the argument on the part of the plaintiffs, the Democratic Party here, is that these kinds of prohibitions, say on ballot harvesting, they have a disparate impact on certain kinds of voters, and thereby it should be held illegal under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. But then the state of Arizona comes back and says that it's actually designed to prevent fraud or whatever, and that it's not motivated by any desire to suppress voters based on race. And so those are the kinds of considerations that the justices are kind of trying to sort through, and that we'll see when they decide how they've kind of figured out what the test there should be.
Those are the four big cases this term. One that will be getting a lot of attention, and it's not necessarily this term, but it has to do with abortion. Any timetable on that?
Well, they decided just a couple weeks ago to hear this case coming out of Mississippi that is a post 15-week abortion ban, and so they decided to hear that case. It'll come up next term. It'll probably be argued, I guess, in the fall, most likely, depending on the briefing schedule and when the court calendars oral argument for next year. And then we'll probably get a decision on that case roughly about a year from now at the end of the term next year.
Yeah, so this time next year that ruling could come down. Dr. Michael Moreland is professor of law and religion with the Villanova University School of Law. Dr. Moreland, thank you very much for being with us today.
It was a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Where to locate casinos usually attract a lot of attention, both for and against. Advocates and opponents to the Parks Casino application near Shippensburg in Shippensburg Township met at a public hearing in May to present final arguments for and against the facility before the Pennsylvania Gaming Control Board makes a decision on the matter. Two other central Pennsylvania communities have already declined the casino, and opponents want Shippensburg to do the same. Joining us today is Reverend Jim Rogers. He's the senior pastor with the Shippensburg First Church of God and an active member of the Shippensburg United Group. They oppose the casino. It's a mini casino, by the way. And Wayne Groover, a member of Shippensburg United. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org on Twitter. We are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Reverend Jim Rogers, I understand you like going by Pastor Jim, so I'll call you Pastor Jim. You oppose this mini casino. Why?
Well, we are a small rural town, a family-oriented town, and we believe a casino is going to bring increased crime, addictions, and hardships to people that are less fortunate. And all of the studies that you look at, done by universities and various other places, all bear that out. And not to mention that we also have a university here in Shippensburg, and there's going to be college sports betting at this location if it comes, and that offers a lot of temptations and possible hardships for college students.
Wayne Groover, I assume that you oppose for many of the same reasons?
That is correct. Primarily, it is that I believe it really does prey on the most vulnerable. And Shippensburg is an area that there's a lot of financial hardship. According to GoBank rates, rate.com, 50% of the people in this area have less than, have no savings, and 70% have less than $1,000 in savings. And so I believe the studies show that the casinos will have a negative effect, and primarily on those that are the most vulnerable.
Well, Mr. Groover, just the reasons you mentioned, those who support this mini casino say that's the reason that that they support it is the economic reasons. It would create 75 full-time jobs, 100 part-time jobs, and a study has said that it will bring $41 million into the local economy. So, you know, just what you talked about many people in the Shippensburg area, you know, having some financial hardships, that this would provide some jobs and would bring some money into the community.
Yeah, you mentioned the $41 million, and that is a number that I do understand is correct. Of that $41 million, basically the township and Cumberland County get about $1.8 million. The township specifically gets $700,000. And that really means that $36 million, somewhere in that neighborhood, is leaving this area. So to me, it's a very poor return on investment. And the other thing that studies show, Earl Grinnell's out of the University of Illinois has been quoted in saying that we can expect $3 in social costs for every dollar of benefits. So to me, this just doesn't make sense financially. So yes, if we were truly bringing good jobs, I'd be all for it.
Pastor
There's
Jim.
There's also another financial cost, if I could. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, I was going to comment on the financial costs also, that 30% of those supposed jobs created will go outside of the community. And the National Association of Realtors has also done impact studies and shown that it's a negative on housing markets, that property values go down, foreclosures go up, and therefore the tax revenue that comes in from property taxes goes down. So the numbers really show that communities lose money. They don't make money when casinos come in.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about that research. When you say that the research shows that the property values go down, at what proximity to the casino? Because, I mean, are we talking a mile, 2 miles, 5 miles from the casino that property values are impacted, or just what?
Well, I don't have those exact figures. I'm quoting from a study that was done in Western Massachusetts on an area community where a casino was coming in, and they showed that there was an estimated 125 more foreclosures per year in that particular area, with $5 million in lost home value. So that's one area that was negatively impacted by casinos coming into the area. And if it happens in one area, it most likely will happen in another.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because you said that, you know, the studies have shown that there have been increases in crime, increases in gambling addiction. And you said addiction, so I'm assuming you mean gambling, but probably other substance abuses as well. I look at Penn National in Grantville. Now, in some ways, it's a good comparison, because Grantville, a rural community in Dauphin County, and, you know, many of the same arguments were made when casino gambling, at first it was slot machines, were legalized in Pennsylvania in 2004. Now, why it's not a good apples-to-apples comparison is that the Penn National Hollywood Casino is much larger than this mini-casino that is being proposed for Shippensburg Township. But, you know, the studies over the years have not shown that the area around Grantville or around the casino has experienced many of the crime, traffic, addiction problems that were forecast. So, I mean, do we know is there a good one-on-one comparison, and what evidence do you have that those things will happen?
Well, all I can go by is the various studies in other areas that have been done where there are communities that have casinos. For instance, the National Gambling Impact Study Commission found that gambling addictions will increase by approximately 10% within a 50-mile radius of casinos. And I know every community is different, every casino is different, but the overwhelming evidence of various communities across the country when casinos come in is negative. And again, let's just say this. Let's say that just hypothetically, some communities do bring in some extra money because of a casino. Since when does some added financial increases justify doing something that's wrong, whenever the statistics clearly show that casinos make the majority of their money off of those who are addicted, people who are in the casino 4 and 5 times a week, as Mr. Groover pointed out, people that have zero money in their savings are the majority of the, or I should say half, make up half the people that visit casinos. And so then that impacts families and their ability to be able to pay their bills and provide food for their children. So if you take a cross section of the studies across America, the studies show that it's a negative impact.
If I could add there.
Go ahead, bud.
Yeah. I think one of the areas that I is really hit home to me was as I looked at this originally, you know, I thought, hey, a little bit of entertainment value, you know, what's the big deal? But when past president Dave Jonas talked about, one of his comments was we underestimated significantly how many trips our customers are going to make. At parks, it's 150 to 200 trips a year. That's 3 to 4 times a week, and many come more often. We have customers who give $20 to $30 5 times a week. And they also talk about, in that same study I was referring to earlier about Earl Grinnell's, that, you know, the vast majority of this money is really coming from a 35-mile radius. So I don't have the statistics on whether there's crime increases, but I do know that when you increase financial hardship, and this really is going to prey on the most vulnerable among us, that you're going to have some negative effects on that. And I really am deeply concerned about those that do have gambling addiction. Everyone agrees that whether it's the casino, that problem gambling is an issue. And everyone agrees that it will increase to some degree. And I just really struggle to put a price tag on the value of a human life. I know we're, in essence, we're doing that. Shippensburg Townships put $700,000 on that. I struggle deeply with that concept. And I struggle for those with mental illness, those that, you know, have manic episodes and are obsessed, you know, with going in. In Grinnell's study, he just talks about, one I referenced, that just that addictive power of going in and just thinking that next pool is going to be life-changing. And so it's really not a good thing.
Mm-hmm. But let me just counter that, because I know there would be people, these are not my opinions, I'm just raising the question. But, I mean, is it the majority of people who are going to a casino are doing it, Mr. Groover, probably for what you suggested, entertainment? Now, I have no idea what, how often people return, and I would say that those who go 3 or 4 times a week are probably in the minority. I see you shaking your head, Pastor Jim. Yeah. I can see him, by the way, in a Zoom. Are you saying that's not the case?
Well, information coming out of an organization called Stop Predatory Gambling has shown that the casinos make the majority of their money from those people, as Mr. Gruber said, that come 3, 4, 5 times a week and are addicted to gambling. So the casinos make most of their money from those types of people, not just the occasional visitor who may be looking for something, you know, once or twice a month to do on a weekend. So that shows you that they're profiting, getting rich off of other people's hardships.
I would just add that study with Grinnell's, he stated that pathological gamblers account for 30 to 50% of the revenue, and that each gambler conservatively adds about $10,000 negatively to the community, a cost to the community. So, and I believe that, you know, going back to what David Jonas, the past president of Parks, said, you know, that's really their bread and butter, these types of people. They really do prey on that. These people are coming in 5 times a week, and they're dropping $50, you know, $100 a time. You know, I think he quoted 25 to 35. I've heard it's higher than that in some cases, but that's usually the 25 to 35. You know, that's $400 or $500 a month for people that really don't have the money to do it. And so This isn't, you know, this isn't the casino where you're going to have somebody fly in the weekend from Singapore, you know, with $1 million. This is slot machines, and they're basically drawing on the community around them. 80% of the money is supposed to be coming. That, according to Thomas Bonner of Parks, he says that 80% of the patrons are estimated to come within a 25-mile radius. So, again, that's $40 million leaving this community for maybe about $5 million in payroll, and maybe we're going to get $700,000 for the township and $1.8 million for Cumberland County. The economics are not there. We as a community can do better and really need to do better than this. Our leadership really needs to step up and not take easy, what they view as easy routes out. They need to bring in things that are going to really help the community. I've never seen anywhere where doing something negative is going to help in the long run. And that's really what they're doing.
Pastor Jim, you know, the arguments that you and Wing Groover are making against this mini casino being proposed for Shippensburg Township are many of the same, almost the exact same, that have been made any time there has been a casino proposed, especially in rural areas. But I go back even further to 2004 when casino gambling, or at that time just slot machines, were approved in Pennsylvania. I mean, are you opposed to gambling, period? And if that be the case, why is the state of Pennsylvania involved in this?
Well, yeah, I'm against gambling, period. And I think where the mistake was made was originally the state making it legal to have gambling in Pennsylvania. If they hadn't done that, we wouldn't be facing this situation and all these different communities that are trying to keep casinos out. It's because the state government approved it. So, yeah, I don't think it should have ever been done to start with. And I'm against it overall because of the things that we've stated, you know, because of the negative impact on you know, the money coming into the community. It affects jobs in the community because local businesses are negatively affected because a lot of the business goes to the casinos. There's increased crime. According to a guest speaker that we had from Stop Predatory Gambling, oftentimes organized crime uses casinos to launder money. And so there's property values, as I said before, go down. In addictions to various things go up, not just gambling, but other types of addictions. And so, you know, we at least as Christians don't want to see an organization come into our town that's going to hurt people or that's going to negatively affect our community. So that's the reason we're taking a stand against it. A lot of people say, well, churches shouldn't be involved in politics. Well, whenever politics, quote unquote, negatively impact human beings, that's where Christians need to get involved. And so that's the reason that our church and many other believers and churches in Shippensburg are taking a public stand against this.
Something you just said, and I can't let it go if we can't prove it, but you said about organized crime laundering money. I know that in Atlantic City was and Las Vegas over the years that things like that may have occurred. As some have pointed out, the proponents of this, that we're talking Shippensburg and we're talking a mini casino. We only have about a minute left in the program. And, you know, from a land use perspective, the project meets all the requirements: public utility service, parking, fire truck access, distance from protected classes of properties like neighborhoods, churches, or schools. So why would the board say no?
If I could just chime in.
And I have about 30 seconds.
Yeah, the application that was submitted, it was very poorly done. With all the changes that occurred, they really made no significant updates. And one of the things that we talk about is that there's 850,000 expected visitors a year. And they're saying that there's no road impact, no significant road impact. And so there's just a lot of things with the application process. There's a lot of things around Shippensburg Township making this decision and it impacts people within a very, very short area within a mile. There's other townships. And, you know, I just leave you with this thought. Success in the gambling industry only comes at someone else's expense. Let me repeat that. Success in the gambling industry only comes at someone else's expense.
Gentlemen, I have to cut you off because I'm running out of time. By the way, we did invite Shippensburg Township, and they declined our invitation to appear on the program. Reverend Jim Rogers, senior pastor of Shippensburg, First Church of God, Wayne Groover, member of Shippensburg United. I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a good day.